Thank you, John, and welcome everybody, and welcome friends here and also online. As John said, tonight we are going to explore the power of thought and see how this impacts our lives. When the Theosophical Society started talking about this idea that thought has an intrinsic power, the idea was quite unknown, and most people didn't believe it. Today, a large or relatively large portion of humanity believes that there is some kind of power in our thinking. From a psychological power, in the sense of the effect of thought on our own being, to the idea that with our thoughts we can modify the universe around. Some views may be a little exaggerated, some other views may be more rational, and we are going to explore to what extent, at least from a theosophical point of view, thought has a power and how we can use it in a correct way. Because powers are, they are all kinds of powers. I mean, our intelligence is a power. Our ability to speak is a power. Our ability to do things are different kinds of powers. And we have transformed the world with the powers that we have as as human beings. Something that animals, for example, have not been able to do. They can modify the environment to some extent, but they don't have the ability to produce such an impact in the world as we do. And if we don't know what kind of powers we have and how they work, and what's their proper use, we may misuse them. On the contrary, if we know about these powers and we learn how to use them, we can actually produce effects that can be beneficial for us and for the whole humanity. So the idea is to explore this power that is in our consciousness and see the extent of it and its limitations. So at the beginning, when the Theosophical Society was founded, the background that was there, for those who were interested in some kind of spirituality beyond the range of normal religions, especially here in the West, they could know about what was called mesmerism, which was the beginning of the idea of energy healing. Mesmer said that we human beings have some kind of what he called animal magnetism. Today, maybe we would call it biomagnetism, animal in the sense that it was not something, the magnetism of a magnet, it was something biological. So there was some kind of biomagnetism, let's say, in ourselves that we could project, and with that we could cure people. Or we could put people in trance, a kind of hypnotism. Also at that time, at the time when the Theosophical Society was founded in 1875, a book came out by a person that would become the founder of the Christian Science, Mary Baker. And she published a book where she said that illnesses were not real. They were the result of a mistaken belief. In her view, the whole universe was only mind. Everything that we see is just a projection of our mind. And we have illnesses because we believe that illnesses exist. So you don't cure illnesses with remedies or with drugs. You cure illnesses with your mind, changing your beliefs. So she devised this model or this technique of developing some affirmations that would deny the existence of illnesses and would affirm the existence of a state of health, for example. So she would say, if you only stop believing that illnesses exist, you will be cured, because the problem is a wrong belief. Of course, the force behind that was the force of faith, not so much the idea that our thought was modifying the body, for example. It was a question of belief. But there was the idea there that the mind was making something real by believing in it. Of course, this tradition existed in the East for many centuries and millennia, just to talk about a philosophy that was very strong in this point of view. It's a school of Indian Buddhism, the Yogacara tradition, which sometimes is called Chittamatra. That's the Sanskrit word, which means mind only or consciousness only. They also said the whole universe is just an expression of consciousness. Now, in the East, they always seem to have a far deeper view as to the metaphysics behind particular statements. So, for example, they would say, since everything is consciousness, your body itself is not real. Not only the illnesses are not real. Your body itself is not real. You are confused thinking that you are this body. And you imagine that you have this body, but you are consciousness only, as the whole world is. So they weren't very concerned about the body, whether healthy or unhealthy. They wanted to go even beyond that and help people recognize that there was only consciousness in the universe. Now, in the Western view, in the Christian science, they didn't go so far. Yes, everything is mind, but they were still concerned about the body and the health of the body. And that marked the direction in which this point of view was going to develop, because it's a big part of what we call the New Age came from this stream of thought. Soon after the creation of the Christian science came another movement, the mental science. They said, this is not a Christian science or a Buddhist science or whatever it is. This is a mental science. And then the idea that your mind was affecting the cure began to be more clear. In the Christian science, the idea is that God is the source of your faith in God, and the creation of God, that the creation of the universe by God as only mind, when you know this, that is what will heal you. They were saying this is how Jesus healed. When he healed somebody, he said, your faith has healed you, not myself. So that's why she was saying this is a Christian science, because this is the science that Jesus used. But then another movement said, this is not really, you know, a Christian science or any other denomination. This is your mind curing yourself. So the concern always was related to the body and the health of the body. And then later on, there was another development of this movement that started the New Thought movement, in which a person that was very relevant there was Atkinson. He wrote this book about the law of attraction. So a natural development of this idea, if your mind has the power to cure your body, then your mind also, this power can be used to attract the things that you want. So, you know, one of the subtitles or the titles of the chapters in that book is, nothing is too good for you. You can have everything you want. So the direction of that philosophical line went in what, you know, now we know as, for example, what The Secret, this book, explains. We have a power here. You can manifest anything you want. You just have to ask. You just have to, you know, visualize it. And then you can attract money, a wife or a husband, or push away a wife or a husband, whatever the case. You know, you can use your mind to produce all this. So this is one direction of the idea of the power of thought. Then with quantum physics comes this idea that in some way the observer affects the thing that you are observing. In some way there is this idea that the act of measuring something modifies that. We don't have time to go into this, but from a scientific point of view, it's not quite that. That is an interpretation by people who, you know, want to put a spiritual slant on what science is researching. But that is another question. Nevertheless, the idea that the world is a world of possibilities, probabilities, and that we are the ones that collapse the probabilities in one particular outcome or the other, this is something that a group of people believe today. So these are more or less some views about how our consciousness can affect the environment, can affect ourselves. And of course, there is the psychological line of development, which try to develop always within a scientific environment, in which our thoughts can produce, you know, psychological problems, which in turn can produce physiological problems, and how our mind can condition our behavior. So this is one line of how the mind may affect us and the environment. Now, when this movement of Christian science and later, you know, the New Thought movement began, the Theosophical Society was being founded by a group of people, among which was Madame Blavatsky. She's one of the co-founder of the society. She was already quite famous worldwide when she founded the Theosophical Society for something that is related to this idea that our mind can produce visible effects in the world. She was known because somehow she was able to produce, as I said, some visible effects on objects by the mere power of her mind, her will, her thinking. So at the beginning, for example, she would go into seances. At the time, spiritualism was very prominent, and many people, even scientists, were part of this movement. They were trying to research into how do these things happen, because in spiritualism, there were many phenomena that are very difficult to explain, even today. You know, for example, two rings that were interlaced and that a spirit could bring, you know, break them apart without altering the rings, or knots that could be undone without going through the reverse motion, you know, by which you made the knot, or wrappings on tables when nobody was touching them, or in many cases even some objects would appear out of nothing. And Blavatsky started going to these seances, and she tried to show that all these powers that were ascribed to these spirits were actually in human nature, were part of human nature. So she performed many psychic phenomena. She would, you know, you would have some a piece of a blank piece of paper or linen, and then she would cover it and sit next to it and then uncover it, and there was a painting there. With many witnesses, with scientists there, with educated people. We have some of those paintings in the museum in the Theosophical Society in India, which is the headquarters. Or in India, she was with a group of people that were not theosophists that came to her interested in what she could do. And they would say, okay, let us do an experiment. Why don't you precipitate, that's the word they were using, precipitating something. Why don't you precipitate a cup somewhere, for example? They were in a picnic, they had brought 12 cups. There was a 13th person that was unexpected there, and British people, the British in India, you know, tea is very important. So if you don't have a cup for the 13th person, that's a problem. So they said, well, why don't you precipitate a cup? And Blavatsky said, okay, tell me, where do you want to precipitate it? They discussed among them. They said, here, there, no. Well, they voted and they said, you see that tree there, underneath the tree. So she sat for a few moments in meditation, and then she said, go dig under the roots and you will find the teacup. And they did. They saw that the ground wasn't removed. It was hard for them to, you know, they didn't have tools there, so they were with a spoon, you know, removing the ground. And they found the cup that was the exact match of the other 12, with a cup and a saucer. We also have that cup over there in the museum. And
part of why she did this is because she wanted to show in practical terms that was that there was far more in the universe that we knew. At the time, science, when I have a scientific background, I have a PhD in molecular biology, and when you go through your science training, when you study the history of science, the end of the 19th century was probably the point in which scientists were the most sure of themselves. They were saying that science was about to end in a decade or so, because they were going to be able to explain everything in the universe. Of course, they didn't even know what the atoms were. They thought they were little billiard balls, you know, with solid, with no motion, no division, nothing about relativity or anything like that. But they were making people believe, educated people believe, that you could explain the whole universe by mechanical laws and by matter. There was nothing but that. And many intelligent people were becoming atheist and materialist. So Blavatsky thought that it was important to show, to prove, you know, in a visible way, that there were things scientists could not explain. Of course, this didn't work. People came to her, they liked the phenomena, but it became a kind of circus. They didn't care about the philosophy behind or, you know, which is what Blavatsky really was interested about. So she stopped doing that for the most part. But this really produced a big impact in the mind of humanity. Today we know that in India there have been different people, even Sai Baba, he says that he can also precipitate some powder or some objects. And Blavatsky says this is something that there is a training and people can learn to do it. And she said in India and in the East, there are yogis that can do this. This is nothing that, you know, she was special or anything. She just went through the training. Of course, it's not just the training. It's a kind of hard training. I'll explain, when I explain the mechanism, you will see why. But this produced an impact in humanity and the awakening to the idea that our mind is very important, that we have to pay attention to our mind. Now, what I want to do tonight is to see the effects of our thinking on different levels, on a psychological level, on a physical level, from different points of view, and see why it is important to know about this. So to understand how this works, we have to go through a little, you know, let me give you a little philosophical view about the nature of the universe so that we can understand how this is supposed to work. Because there is a problem with Descartes, who, you know, was a Western philosopher. He said in the universe there are two kinds of things. The mind, which is immaterial, and the objects, which are material, they have extension, you can measure them. The mind is immaterial, you cannot measure it. So it is something completely immaterial and something completely material. So he was a dualist in the sense that he said everything in the universe is composed either of mind or matter. Now the problem is, if this is true, how can the mind that is completely immaterial affect something that is material? The people would say this is like a ghost in a machine. If you have a ghost that cannot touch things, how could a ghost, you know, direct the motion of a machine? You need something that can serve as a bridge between the immaterial and the material. So Blavatsky addressed that problem, and she said, in the universe there are not two principles. There are actually three fundamental principles. And this is how you solve the problem of the ghost in the machine. So one of the principles, she said, is what we call matter, which is easy to see. So matter is one of the principles. Then we have the other principle on the other side, let's say, that we can call consciousness, or mind, or however you want to call it. And then she said, there is something in between, a bridge between these two, that allows changes in consciousness to affect matter, and changes in matter to affect consciousness. And she used a technical word, but let us say energy. There is a kind of energy. So what she explained is that every change in consciousness produces a kind of energy that is able to affect matter. And if you think, for example, if I move my hand, this first was a thought that is immaterial, at least from, you know, the physical point of view. The thought, you cannot measure the thought itself. You can measure the effects of the thought in the brain. You know, you can measure the electric activity and all that, but the thought itself, I remember a professor of physics that came and said, something is scientific if you can measure it. If you cannot measure it, that is beyond science. Therefore, thought is not a scientific reality, even though thought developed science, but it's not a scientific reality because you cannot measure thought. Look, if I think about moving my hand, and I move my hand, how did that happen? How could something immaterial produce a physical motion? So the idea is that what Blavatsky explained is that the electric activity that you see in the nerves is the effect of this energy. So you have consciousness. The change in consciousness produces an energy that manifests on the physical as electric or electromagnetic activity. So she said in the universe, this always works in that way. On any aspect of the universe that you think about, there are these three elements. There are changes in consciousness, there is an energy that produces, and that energy moves matter. So the idea is that, you know, today in quantum physics, we are beginning to see this. We know that every particle of matter has an aspect of energy. This Einstein, you know, the famous formula that makes the conversion between matter and energy. So we know that there is an aspect of matter that is energy, or the other way around. There is an aspect of energy that is matter. So if you modify one, you can modify the other, and vice versa. Blavatsky was saying, yes, this is true, and she said it before science discovered this, but she says there is one third aspect that science has not discovered at the moment, or so far, which is there is also a consciousness there. In every particle, there is some kind of consciousness. Not the kind of human consciousness. It's not that the electron, you know, in this famous experiment of the two slits, we can talk about that if we have time. It's not that the electron comes and thinks, should I go through one or the other? Should I go as a wave or as a particle? It's not that kind of consciousness. That is a mental consciousness. However, in the theosophical view, everything in the universe has a kind of consciousness of its own. So these three aspects are fundamental to the universe. This is the first thing that will be useful for us to understand how this works. The second aspect that we need to be familiar with is that matter exists in many different ways, in many different states. So, for example, if you think of a primitive humanity, probably human beings thought that there were two types of matter, solid and liquid. The, you know, gases, because they are not visible, they probably were outside the conception of these people. So liquid and solid. Then as we grow and learn, we learn that right here there are many gases. We cannot see them, but we developed ways to measure the gases here. So there is a state of matter that is quite invisible in normal circumstances, but it is there. And we learn how to manipulate that. So now we have solid, liquid, and gases. Now there is a fourth state of matter that many people are unaware of, which is what we call plasma. Now, our plasma TVs use this kind of this state of matter. It's a kind of electromagnetic state of matter. So this state of matter is even subtler than the gases. For a long time, plasma was a non-scientific idea. Actually, in theosophy, Blavatsky used to call it ether, and scientists were saying there is nothing like ether. Well, that ether is what they call now plasma. So little by little, science discovers deeper and deeper aspects of matter, or subtler aspects. Now, theosophy says there is not only these states of matter, there is also subtler aspects or states of matter that we can call a kind of emotional matter. Why? Because this is a matter that is set in motion by our feelings, our emotions. You know, the physical matter we know is set in motion by physical actions. I push this and it moves. But there is some kind of matter that is so subtle that no physical motion really affects it. And this is why it's very difficult for science to discover it, because science uses all physical instruments to detect it. So even this idea of the dark matter, for example, science doesn't know what dark matter is, because it cannot really measure the dark matter. This is why they call it dark. The only thing they can see is that there is something there they cannot see, they cannot measure, they cannot detect in any way, but they know there is something there because of the effects that this has on gravity. They see that there is far more gravity than the mass that they can measure there accounts for. So in an indirect way, they see that there is some matter there that is, it doesn't seem to be physical. So anyway, the idea is that this emotional matter is so subtle that it's not affected by physical matter. But it is affected by this psychological activity that we call emotions. And not only that kind of emotional matter, there is a kind of matter that is even subtler than the emotional that we can call mental matter. Because this kind of matter is affected by our thoughts. So let's say, and there are higher kinds of matter, but for our purpose today, we don't need to deal with them. So let us say that there is a kind of physical matter that we all perceive with our senses, although the higher states, we need instruments to perceive it. There is some kind of emotional matter, and there is some kind of mental matter. Now, if this principle of the idea that there is matter, energy, and consciousness everywhere in the universe is true, then there is a kind of mental energy and there is a kind of mental consciousness. We know the mental consciousness. Mental consciousness is what we call thinking. And there is a kind of mental energy, or there has to be a kind of mental energy if this idea of these three aspects is true. Then, in the same way, there has to be some kind of emotional energy, and there is a kind of emotional consciousness. This is what we call feelings, desires, and all this. And then, well, we know this about the physical, at least we know about the matter and the energy at the physical level, not so far the consciousness. So with this, we will be able to understand this idea that thoughts can have an actual effect, because we are saying that thoughts are not something merely subjective that happens only in our minds. We are saying that our mental consciousness has some kind of energy and produces some effects on a kind of matter that is subtle that we are calling mental matter. Now, there is something else that is important to see, and we are going to talk about this later, but there is a kind of relationship between these different states of matter, a kind of resonance. You know, the phenomenon of resonance is that if you make something vibrate, you put a glass here, if there is another glass that shares the same kind of frequency, by hitting one glass, you may make the other glass ring. There is a phenomenon of resonance, or with a harp with different, you know, chords, or with different objects. So there is a kind of resonance between all these states. When a certain kind of mental matter is active, it makes the emotional matter vibrate, and this makes the physical matter vibrate. And the other way around too, the physical may produce an emotional response and a mental response. We can see that in ourselves. We can see how certain physical impacts produce an emotional and mental response, and some mental impacts or activity produces an emotional and a physical response. This is why our mind may have an effect on the health of our bodies, for example, why there is a connection. But we are going to talk about that later. I want to first talk about the effects of our thoughts on the mental and emotional planes or dimensions or aspects of ourselves. So let me read something that I think, as far as I know, especially in the West, the first written explanation about thoughts being some kind of thing was written in a theosophical book by one of Blavatsky's teachers in the 1880s. He was originally from Tibet. He was an Indian living in Tibet, Indian yogi or enlightened beings, let's say, living in Tibet. And he was communicating with a couple of Englishmen and beginning to teach some of this. And he said, every thought of a person upon being produced passes into the inner world. By inner world, he means these subtler planes, the emotional and mental planes, and becomes an active entity by associating itself with some semi-intelligent forces that exist that science don't know about it. So let's say, for the time being, when we produce a thought, it associates itself with some mental and emotional energy. And he says, this form, which actually produces a form, survives as an active intelligence, a creature of the mind's begetting, for a longer or shorter period, proportionate with the original intensity of the brain action that generated it. Thus, a good thought is perpetuated as an active beneficent power, an evil one as a kind of maleficent demon. And so, every person is continually peopling his current in space with a world of his own, crowded with the offspring of his fancies, desires, impulses, passions, a current which reacts upon any nervous organization which is around. And he said, the Buddhists call this skanda, and the Hindu gives it the name of karma. The adept or a yogi evolves these shapes consciously, and other people throw them off unconsciously. So what he's saying there is that every time we think, we put in motion some kind of energy which affects the mental matter and generates a kind of entity. Why a kind of entity? The idea is that when I have a thought with one particular quality, let's say a thought of love, that awakens a certain aspect of the mental energy that has a resonance with a certain kind of mental matter. There are different kinds of mental matters, as there are different kinds of physical matter. So the question is that when I have a thought and a feeling of love, let's say we generate a kind of matter that comes together that is vibrating with certain energy. Now, this on the mental plane is an objective object, let's say. It's something that people who can see on the mental plane that we call clairvoyance, they can actually see this bubble, or they have different shapes, we are not going to go into that, of kind of mental matter and energy. And this is floating, you know, on the mental plane, and any person that comes close and gets in touch with this, this produces by resonance the same kind of feeling or thought in the person that comes next to it. So this, as the master said there, Blavatsky's teacher said there, this can become a beneficent force if it is a thought of love, or make become a kind of demon if it is was formed by hate, because it tends to generate the same kind of feeling in other people. So you feel this when you go into a place many times. You can sense the feeling of that place. When you get in touch with a person, many times you can sense the person's, you know, atmosphere, just to put it some name. This is because every time we think or feel something, we generate these little entities around us, and as the master says there, we go through life surrounded by what we are generating. So we relate to people through this kind of atmosphere, this kind of what we call aura, let's call it aura. And that aura, because other people have their own auras, tend to reproduce in the other person a similar effect. So this is one aspect of this. We'll go little by little into the connotations of this. But so you have this aura that every time we think or feel something, it begins to be part of ourselves. Now, that becomes also a kind of glass through which we look at the world. Because if we have, you know, many thought forms, let us call them thought forms, that are related to love or peace or harmony, when we relate to other people, we relate to through these thought forms. So we will perceive other people, you know, in this case, through a kind of glass that I'm using the example of glass, like if you have blue glasses, you see everything tainted by blue. If you have yellow glasses, everything tainted by yellow. So if you have harmonious thought forms, you will see the positive aspects of things. If you have inharmonious ones, you will see the negative aspect of things. So these things that you are producing not only affect other people and therefore their response to you, because if you get close to a person and that person feels, you know, love, that person will treat you in a particular way. If that person feels antagonism because you are full of antagonistic thought forms around, will treat you in a different way. So not only this affects how we relate to other people, but also it affects how we perceive other people. So you can see how, even though we are in the same world, we are in a kind of our own world, each one of us, because we cannot see the world as it is. We see the world through a particular conditioning that is being created by our activity, by what we think, by what we feel every day. So this is, you know, what the master says there, the idea of the skandhas, especially one of the skandhas in Buddhism, the samskara, which is the tendency, the habit that we have in the kind of mental formations, the kind of mental interpretation and response that we have to the world. So if I'm a negative person, I have the habit of looking at the negative aspect of things. If I'm a positive person, the opposite. I'm making it simple. The truth is that most of us are a mix of different things. So this is far more complex than what I'm saying, but just to explain the principle and making it quite simple. So this is a first important aspect. What we think is very relevant in how we live. You know, in the Bible, Jesus says, you don't commit a sin when you actually do it. You commit it when you think of it. You know, your thinking of doing or committing a sin is already a sin. Why? Because he probably was referring to this question. We may not do things because our society doesn't allow it, but if we are constantly thinking of it, even if we try to put on a mask or repress it, we are actually generating a mental organ of perception, so to say, that will through which we will relate to the world and to people. So it is very important to begin to pay attention to what we are thinking, what we are feeling, what do we stimulate in our life, what kind of TV or things, you know, watch, or what kind of literature we read, what kind of thoughts and emotions are constantly being produced in ourselves. So awareness of what we are thinking, of what we are feeling, is the first key to begin to build this atmosphere around us in a way that is not going to be in detriment, that is not going to be negative for our life. We need to develop a certain awareness of what we are thinking, what we are feeling. If we don't know what we are feeling or thinking, then we have no control. Our aura will be produced by the environment. If somebody treats me well, I will feel well, I will respond, you know, in a positive way. If somebody treats me ill, I will respond in a negative way. And therefore, I am generating thought forms and this atmosphere around me according to the environment. I'm a slave of the environment. If I start developing awareness, then I begin to be able to select. A person may be treating me ill, but if I recognize this, I have the opportunity to try to let go of the negative thoughts or emotions. Because after all, they are affecting yourself. They are affecting also the other person. If we have time, we will talk about that. But they are affecting yourself. So when you start really understanding all this, you see that it's useless to harbor ill feelings because they are poisoning your own consciousness. So once there is awareness, we may have the possibility of selecting, effect a kind of selection of what particular thoughts and emotions I let come into my field of consciousness. You know, again, in the Bible, you see Jesus expelling from the church all these people that were doing business in the church, and quite violently he was, you know, throwing them out. And that is a symbol for what are we letting come into the temple of our consciousness? Are we letting all these thoughts, negative thoughts and emotions, these robbers, to come and have their being in the temple of our consciousness? Or are we keeping a watch and, as Jesus did, you know, get rid of those who are going to taint that temple that is our consciousness? So once we develop a certain awareness, we can develop this kind of selection. So when we see that there is a negative thought or a negative emotion in ourselves, we can develop some strategies to get rid of them. One of them is, you know, we can think only one thing at a time. So one aspect of it is try to turn your mind into something positive, into some positive thought. So whenever, you know, something may happen that made you upset, when the thought comes to your mind, you recognize it, that it is there. You don't repress it. You recognize it, and you say, you know what? I don't want to feed this. So you turn your mind towards something that is positive. You know, if you have some thoughts that you read that are inspiring, maybe start thinking of that. Or if you have a project that is good for, you know, it's a good work for the community, for other people, for your family, start thinking of this work or planning it. turn your mind into something positive. So not only that you don't engage in a negative thought, but you start generating more of the positive thoughts. But if you cannot do that, because when we are upset, sometimes the upsetting is too strong to turn our minds into something positive, at least, you know, consciously distract your mind from the negative thought. It's not the best solution, but it's better than engaging in and getting entangled in a negative, you know, in a process of feeding the negative. So you can recognize the negative thought. If you cannot think of something positive, you know, turn your mind into something that is neutral, or doing gardening, or doing something, you know, try not to give energy to the negative thoughts or emotions. So, you know, this can be like a conscious distraction. And in time, you will be able to turn your mind into something positive. And when you acquire even more skill, you will be able to just drop it. You know, when you develop this awareness more and more, the awareness itself has the power that a negative thought comes, you realize it, and you just drop it. You say, you know, I don't want to engage in this. And you go on with your day. But that's something that requires a little more more practice. But it's attainable by anybody. So it's like anything else. With practice, by doing this, in time, you can do this very easily. So your thoughts have a very, very important aspect in the psychological field of your life, how you perceive the world, how you relate to the world. And if you see, most of our problems are of a psychological nature. You know, we may have some physical problems, some illnesses, but if you see the sources of our problems in our daily life are emotional, or they are mental problems. So if you start working on this, this will gradually change your personality, your character. And that in itself becomes a very important power in transforming your life. Now, the other aspect, we don't have a lot of time, but I wanted to touch briefly about this other aspect of the effects on your physical body. So as we said, there is this process of resonance by which negative states of mind and of emotion may repercute on the physical body and produce a state of disharmony in the physical body, which is what we call illness. So as a principle, you know, the Greeks used to say, a healthy mind in a healthy body. There is a connection between your state of mind and the state of your body. So generally speaking, and we know that all the illnesses that are produced by stress and by anguish and all these things. So generally speaking, a state of mind that is more harmonious will lead to a better health. Now, here we have to take some other things into consideration, because this is a thought that is quite known among people who are interested in spirituality, how your mind affects your body. But we may go to an extreme and think that anything that is happening to your body is the result of how you are thinking now. So you may have a person that has cancer, and then somebody will come and say, well, it's your fault because your thinking is wrong. So not only you have the cancer now, you feel guilty because you produced that cancer. And you say, I'm not doing anything wrong, and yet I'm having this result. You know, the problem is that when we oversimplify any truth, it becomes a lie. It becomes untruth. So this is why it is important to have a better knowledge of things and not try to go to the more simplistic view. But our body is the result not only of what we are doing today, it's also the result of causes that were produced in the past, not only in this lifetime, but in previous lifetimes. There is this idea of karma that probably many of you are familiar with. So in our body, there are many things that are manifesting right now in your body that were generated in previous lifetimes. So no matter how good your psychological health is, your body may still be affected by previous causes. So obviously, always to have a better healthy mind will help the body to be healthier. But that doesn't mean that you are never going to get ill. There are many examples of very spiritual people, very sane people, and they have ill health, or they have problems in many different aspects of their body. They meditate, they may have a life of meditation and yet have physical problems, because it is not as simple as what normally is said. You know, just change your thought and suddenly you will have perfect health. And this is important to know, because normally when this happens, you are doing everything you can expecting that you are going to be perfectly healthy, and yet that doesn't work. You think there is something wrong with me. This is not for me, I'm not good enough. Or you say this is, you know, spirituality is a lie, and you abandon it. So it is important to know that our mind does affect our body, but there are many other causes that are also producing an effect there. So when you look at your health, I think we have to look at it from a more philosophical point of view. We need to try to lead a physical life that is as healthy as possible, a psychological life that is also healthy, but also any experience that comes, any difficult experience, because we normally don't complain about the nice experiences. We don't say, why is this happening to me? Why did I, you know, win in the lottery $1 million? We don't say that. We say, why is this happening to me when something wrong happens, when something that we don't like? But if we can have a more philosophical view and understand that anything that happens, whether it produces pleasure or pain, it has a far more transcendental aim that brings us immediate pain or pleasure. It has the aim of discovering our true nature. And that is something far more transcendental than any amount of pain or pleasure that you may have at the moment. If we can really understand this, and of course, for this, you know, we need to study about this and meditate on this and discuss with others so that we understand it deeper and deeper. When we understand that, then we are able to take life as it comes. And that very attitude will help your psychological aspect to deal with whatever comes, good or bad in your eyes, or pleasant or unpleasant, with a truly positive attitude. And that itself begins to be a circle, because, you know, the positive attitude produces more harmony. So this is only a very brief aspect of the power of thought. There are some books, if you are interested in this, some theosophical books that are very very deep and interesting. Annie Besant wrote one that is called Thought Power. She talks about many different aspects of the subject. And you can read that, for example. I chose, because we have only an hour, something that I think is very important regarding the this power, because it is kind of unconscious. It is our normal day-to-day work or thinking or feeling. Then, of course, you can use affirmations to bring things to your life, and they may work, they may not work, because any action that you produce gets mixed up with your previous karma. So no matter how much you desire something, if your previous karma goes in a different direction, that is not going to be manifested. But nevertheless, whenever there is a principle in the universe that the whenever you become a force of acquiring, by acquiring you are depriving others from what you are, you know, gathering for you. And the reaction to that is for the universe to take away from you. When you become the opposite, when you become a force of giving, the reaction to that is that the universe brings more things to you. So this positive thinking that some people say positive thinking is to think, I want to have money, I want to have a house, or whatever, that is actually negative thinking from the karmic point of view. The more you are trying, you know, to acquire, the more the universe will keep taking things away from you. If you start doing the opposite, if your life begins to be more about the common good, then, of course, we need certain things to live. And if you become a force for goodness, the universe will make sure that you have the needs, the things that you need, because you are helping others too. So instead of being so focused on what we want, let us begin to be more focused on what, you know, the community around needs. It may be my family, it may be the country, if you are in a position where your decisions may affect the country, it may be an organization you are part of, whatever group you are part of, begin to be more concerned about what is the best for everybody. And you will see how that way of thinking begins to activate this reaction in the universe that brings things to you. So the power of thought, in the theosophical view, works in the opposite way that is normally taught by some teachers. You want to have, you have to give, not to ask. And the more you ask, the more lack you will feel. But I don't have time to go too much into this. If you read, you know, Annie Besant's, for example, Thought Power, I'll write it here. Or there are many books in the theosophical literature that you can read. You will see the principles behind this. So Annie Besant. So is there any comment or questions about this?
Talked about this concept of resonance and how it sort of the vibrational aspect spreads itself around. Is there sort of like a dissipating effect where how you radiate this resonance can detract or negate a negative force?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it actually works like that. For example, some people say, how can we help? You know, we are in a moment where there is so much violence in the emotional atmosphere of the world. So how can we help? We are not politicians. We don't have, you know, most of us are not. We don't have the power of decision. And actually, not even the politicians have much power of decision, but that's another thing. We may not have enough money to affect this, but there is something very powerful in ourselves. Because of this effect that you are mentioning, if we can remain in a state of harmony and compassion and peace, everything that we are producing, all these thought forms that are constantly being produced by us by keeping that state of consciousness, go and begin to dissipate the hate forms that are being produced by other people. So normally, in the theosophical view, the higher you go into feelings or into thoughts, the more energy they have. So, for example, a thought, and when I say thought, let's say thought slash emotion, you know, because of this process of resonance, the thought forms always are a mixture of thought and emotion. So when you have a thought slash emotion of love, that thought form has far more power than a lot of thought forms of hate. The problem is that in the world, unfortunately, there are far more people that feel irritation than people that feel love, even in our lives. How many times do we feel irritation? How many times do we feel love? So even good people are still giving energy to intolerance or, you know, to reactions. But the more we work on ourselves to stimulate the right kind of vibrations, the more we can affect the world. And many philosophers said, if once in the world there is a critical mass of people that produce an inner transformation, not a big number of people, but it has to be a critical mass, that will produce or induce a change in the whole humanity. So there are, I cannot go into that, but there is a lot of foundations, theoretical foundations to explain why this is true and why we have a lot of power in ourselves.
Could it be that the physical plane is actually a dream or thought form of God, and that miraculous deeds are performed by those who are able to share in the thought-forming capability of God?
Yeah, you can put it that way. There are several philosophies that talk about that. Actually, that's part of the foundation of the Christian Science, in a sense. You know, this is all a thought form, if you want to put it that way, of God. And if we can align ourselves with that, then there won't be illnesses or suffering. Berkeley, the British philosopher, I think was probably one of the first in the West in putting this idea in that way. He said, there is no matter. He was trying to solve this problem of mind and matter that Descartes had said. And he says, there is no matter. Everything is in the mind of God, and this is a dream that God produces. And that is a form of philosophy that is called idealism. Not in the sense of ideals as we normally understand the word, but in the sense of non-objective things. The whole world is a kind of dream. In the theosophical view, it is something like this, because the idea, the process of incarnation, for example, of being embodied, the way it is explained is that the soul begins to produce a mental image that then produces an emotional image that then produces a physical image that is what we call our body. So our body, our emotions, our mind are produced by the, let's say, thought power of the soul. And then when that energy is exhausted, all this is dissolved and the soul is back in its own nature. And so we actually are living in a kind of virtual reality created by our souls, which, in the theosophical view, the souls are simply aspects of this universal consciousness that you can call God if you want. So this idea of the dream, or it's there in many philosophies, especially Eastern philosophies. And in a sense, it's interesting, because if you see a dream is not real, or at least a dream as we normally understand it, it's not real, but it has the ability to produce a permanent effect on you. If you have a dream by which you learn something, that learning remains with you, and it doesn't matter that the dream was not really real. So in the same way, the experiences that the soul have in this kind of virtual reality that they create, even if it is not as real as we would like to think of the world, that experience produces a certain awakening in the soul. It teaches the soul, nevertheless, as we can learn from a dream. So it doesn't really matter. In the West, we are always obsessed with the idea, is this really true? You know, in the East, they tend to say, oh, this is illusion. And then when you say, but what's the point if this is an illusion? But the soul can learn whether this is real or this is a virtual reality. That doesn't really matter at that level.
Based on what we're seeing with a physical matter, I understand health is balance, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking about positive and negative like energy, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we find that balance technically? Because that's what is healthy. A lot of positive essentially is gonna, you know, based on the principle of duality, what is young becomes old, you know, mm-hmm. from old. Young are born, you know, and it's just a process of balance in the end. So mm-hmm. how do you find that balance there?
Yeah. Yes, there are two things that are important at the level of the effect on our health. One is the kind of, the regular, as I said, the regular kind of thoughts and emotions that we produce, that if they are distressful emotions and thoughts, they tend to produce a problem in the body. And that even science has discovered. Now, there is another aspect too. Many times, illnesses are the result of a lack of harmony in the vibration between the different aspects of a human being, between the how we think, how we feel, and how we act. It's like, even, you know, if your thoughts are relatively good, your emotions are relatively good, your physical, you know, the way you eat, the way you sleep, your physical activity is relatively healthy. If there is too much contradiction, inner contradiction, if these bodies are not like aligned, that also produces an illness. So it's very important to get to to some kind of psychological wholeness where we are not so fragmented. Because the problem in our society is that we may be a spiritual person on Sundays or when we go to Mass or on Thursdays when we come to the TS, and then we are the head of a company, and then we are ruthless, and then we are all these different pockets, these different fragments, which in itself produces illness, because the lack of harmony between how I think, how I feel, how I act, or this part of my mind or role in life, this other part of my other role in life, that itself produces illnesses too. So it is very important to the word, maybe, you know, we can use the word integrity, to be the way we are everywhere we are. You know, we are in a certain way. If we have ideals, we act with those ideals anywhere we are. Of course, then there are conflicts because we may think that in order to get a raise in our jobs, we have to betray our ideals. And we many times do it, but we don't realize that that is a cause of illnesses. So to be healthy, I think we have to work on this that I said, you know, to work on developing awareness, a state of self-observation, and try to feed the positive thoughts and emotions and let go of the negative, and to try to bring integration in our consciousness, to be as we are everywhere as much as possible. And this may take, as anything else, it takes time. Gradually we can move in that direction. And that will produce the best state of health that is possible in connection with previous causes, as I said. Because even if you are doing all this, there may be previous causes that will generate some illnesses, but you will be far healthier than if you are not working on this. And perhaps meditation is a good way to help you. You know, sit every morning, even 5 minutes, just trying to, you know, silence has an effect of bringing harmony. So if you sit every morning, even 5 minutes, not to try to do anything, not to try to accomplish anything. Just sit to be in this state of harmony where there are no inner contradictions between what your desires and your thoughts and your aims and this or that. Just sit to be, not to do, not to accomplish, just to be. If you give 5 minutes every day, that produces an integration in your consciousness. That helps, you know, bring together all the energies that are pulled from every you know, different direction in our life. So if you can spend some time in your day for this, that is also a way to be healthy.
You described resonance by proximity. Do you think it's possible to have a resonance that's not dependent upon space?
Yes. There are different planes, as I said. The higher you go on these planes, the less space, as we understand it, have to do with the effects that we produce. So, for example, on the physical plane, space is very important. On the emotional plane, space is not so important. What gets you close to something is more a kind of affinity. If you have affinity for some kind of feelings, you will attract those feelings, even if they were produced in Japan. You know, if you have an affinity for a certain other kind of emotional, so this is why I say everything that is going on around the world, we can affect with our thoughts and emotions, we can affect anywhere in the world. However, even on those planes, the space has some kind of effect. You know, I don't have time to go into that, but whenever we think of something, there are two effects. One is the creation of this thought form. That thought form will go to the place or the person that is connected to that thought. If you think of somebody that is living in India, that thought form will go there. But there is also a kind of undulation, a kind of vibration in the mental and emotional matter around you that will affect anybody that is around you. But that vibration diminishes with space. So that more general effect depends on space, although it goes far, you know, further than even sound. So, but if you can raise your consciousness to the plane that is above the mental, you know, the activity of the mental aspect of ourselves is thoughts. The activity of the emotional is the feelings, emotions. Whenever you are in silence, you are on a plane that is higher than the mental. In that plane, there is no space. In that plane, there is a plane of unity. When you are in silence, your thought may be very different to mine, your emotion, your physical body. But when your mind is in silence, and when my mind is in silence, the state of our two minds is exactly the same. Because silence is not different from one another. Silence is the absence of differences. So whenever we can raise our consciousness to a state of silence, that is a plane of unity. And being aware in this state of silence has a far more powerful effect than anything we can do on the lower planes. Unfortunately, relatively few people are able to stay in this state of silent awareness. But whenever we can do it, even for a second, that produces an effect that affects the whole consciousness of humanity as a whole.
Thank you, Pablo.
All right, and thank you, everybody, for
I'd like to share this Quest magazine from March, April 2008. The cover is color illustrations of thought forms. And there's an interesting article by Gary Lachman, Kandinsky's Thought Forms and the Occult Roots of Modern Art. You can find this online. Go on our website, and you'll be able to read more about it.
Yeah, actually, Kandinsky, because Annie Besant and Leadbeater, who was an associate of her, the two of them were clairvoyants, and they studied painting, or they had a person that could paint and paint the thought forms that they were seeing. They would describe them. And Kandinsky developed this concept of abstract art, you know. He was a member of the Theosophical Society, and he developed that from how the thought forms look and how they signify different things, you know, that is not necessarily connected to the shape itself. So it's a more abstract concept. And he developed the modern abstract art based on this. It's an interesting phenomenon. That
Pablo, you have some of your followers on the internet here, and John mentioned you were going to Crotona, and you could you spend maybe like a minute, because you're still connected with the Theosophical Society, but this is actually going to be exciting training opportunities for your students. You're even going to be teaching more than you are now.
Yeah. I'm still working for the Theosophical Society. There is another Theosophical Center in California, in Ojai, that is called Crotona. So I'll be working from there, developing more classes and all that. There are some people there that can also give classes, but they need some online classes, but they need some help with somebody that knows the technology. So I'm going to go there and help. So even I'll come here a couple of times a year, but we will be producing more online classes from Crotona for the TS here in America. So hopefully all this move will produce more, you know, more possibilities for all of you, for everybody to participate.
Can that change past karma with our thought process?
So she's asking if we can change past karma with our thought process. yes, we can, and how much we can change it depends. It's all a question of energy. There are some karmic causes that were produced by relatively little energy. So if today you change your thoughts about that, that change will neutralize, like the, because these thought forms, as in the quote that I read, the master said, the Buddhists call it skanda, the Hindus karma, because how karma works, it works through these thought forms. Annie Besant wrote another book, Studying Karma, where she explains how these thought forms produce your character and the circumstances that you are put in, and you know, she explains the mechanism of that. So if a particular karmic cause is not very strong, if you change your way of thinking and feeling about something, that may be enough to neutralize it. But if a karmic cause was very strong, you may change your way of thinking and feeling about something, but it still may not be enough to exhaust the whole karmic cause. But in any case, going through the... I mean, we need to look at life as a school. So there are some lessons that we don't like, but that if they are there, it's because they are necessary. It's because there is something that we don't understand or that we have not developed. So to be free, we have to be able to go through that lesson, so to say. And once you understand, once you have an insight in that, or you develop the skill, even if the situation is the same, it doesn't affect you any longer. And there are, you know, people that have all the money and fame and power, and they destroy their lives with excesses of all kinds. And there are people who live in complete poverty, and they are happy as, you know, just to say, Mother Teresa, she lived in a terrible condition, and that was what made her life, you know, fulfilling. And some other people have everything, and they are still unhappy. Actually, we need to discuss, to realize that happiness has nothing to do with environment. But we do that by going through the experiences of life, and then we are free from the environment. That's, you know, if a Greek philosopher, Epictetus, he said, you know, you can even enslave my body, because he was a slave, you can never enslave my mind, and I'm always free no matter what happens with my body. And that is something that is not so far from us, not to that extreme, but we can attain a certain understanding in which external circumstances are not so, you know, that do not affect us so much.